Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton about their new book, The Book of Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience. This was presented by Octavia Books and recorded October 26th at St. Charles Avenue Baptist Church. Hello, gutsy women, and hello, gutsy men. Thank you for being here. It is so exciting to be here with all of you to celebrate Hillary and Chelsea Clinton's wonderful new book, The Book of Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience. We New Orleanians know something about courage and resilience, I think. This is an inspiring collection of true stories of women who have achieved incredible things around the world, and it's written by two women who have moved us all with their courage and personal power. It's the first book they've written together, and I'm sure it won't be the last. A word about our honored guest. Chelsea Clinton advocates tirelessly for girls and women in her books and her work at the Clinton Foundation. She is an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Public health is one of her passions, and we'll talk more about that. She lives in New York City with her husband, her three children, Charlotte, Aiden, and the recently arrived Jasper. She has written six books encouraging young readers to get involved in their world, including She Persisted, American Women Who Changed History, and She Persisted Around the World. One thing is certain. Chelsea Clinton will be persisting. Hillary Rodham Clinton, as you all know, is the first woman in American history to become a major party's presidential nominee after serving as Secretary of State. She has been in public service for more than four decades, using her skills as an attorney, a politician, a first lady, and a United States senator. She has written six books before this one, It Takes a Village, Hard Choices, Living History, and What Happened Among Them. I know of no other politician who has chronicled her public life so scrupulously and so honestly. Her books give us a rare portrait of a woman in power, exercising it for good, no matter the personal price. Please welcome these very gutsy women to New Orleans, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. It is so great to be back in this absolutely wonderful city and to be here with all of you. And thanks for your patience. A lot of people between the storm and the marathon had a little bit of challenge getting here, but we're really looking forward to the conversation.
Me too.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
So first of all, I think of this as the big book of gutsy women because it is a big book and there are a lot of women in it, a lot of wonderful stories. So talk a little bit about what makes a gutsy woman a candidate for this book.
You know, this book arose out of conversations that Chelsea and I have been having since she was a really little girl, because we were always looking for, as my mother did for me, examples, role models, stories of people, but particularly women and girls who overcame obstacles, who persisted in pursuit of their dreams, who helped other people. And over the last several years, as she has traveled for her book, books now, six books, and I think she's been at Octavia before, and as I've traveled, you know, on my various and sundry activities, we have met a lot of children and young people, and particularly little girls, who have asked us, who were your heroes? And we began thinking about how some of the people who we admire are incredibly well known. Everybody knows their name, people know their stories, but there are a lot of women who are favorites of ours because of their courage and resilience, whose stories are maybe not as prominent as they should be or as they once were, or whose whole life of struggle and overcoming challenges are not there. And given the times we're living in, I think we all need examples of how to be courageous and brave and stand up for what we believe and stand up to bullies and be willing to put ourselves on the line for important causes. And these women in this book are not only gutsy because they pursued their own dreams, they are gutsy because they also wanted to help open doors to others. They wanted to protect others. They wanted to help somebody else. And again, I think that's a lesson that we all should be learning and talking about with our kids.
And I just want to echo my mom in thanking everyone here at the church and at Octavia Books for welcoming us so warmly and welcoming us back to New Orleans. And you know, Susan, you did mention that it's a big book. If we had had our way, it would have been even bigger. So when we started off, kind of once we decided we wanted to kind of take this conversation and make it a book, you know, we had a list of hundreds and hundreds of women. And then we actually wrote more than 200 essays. And our editors were like, oh, that's so sweet that you think you could have a book with 200 essays that anyone would ever buy or read, because they would not be able to like take it off of the bookshelf in a store or the library. And so that was painful but necessary advice. And we really thought, again, just as my mom was saying, like, which of these women really were gutsy, both in pursuing their own purpose but in really kind of paving the way for others and often bringing others along with them. And that was kind of the framework that we used to get to the 103 women that we write about in the book.
Well, let's start by talking about the four women on the cover of the book. When I first saw that photograph, it kind of echoed for me the Marines at Iwo Jima, you know, because it's such a powerful photograph of people pulling together and moving towards something together. So talk about rescuing these lost women.
So this is a photograph that maybe you were familiar with. It was one that I had seen, but for many, many years, these women's names were unknown. It also wasn't really clear kind of when the photograph had been taken. And a librarian in Hawaii, Dorothea Buckingham, just decided one day a few years ago that she would kind of get to the bottom of the story, that she would name these women, kind of determine kind of when this image had been taken, and kind of really give context and substance to this epitome of gutsiness. And so she searched through the archives in Hawaii, and she found out that this image was taken from the summer of 1941, and it's from Pearl Harbor. And these women were part of a training exercise to help fill out the ranks of the firefighting brigade in Pearl Harbor, because there weren't enough men. And these women stepped forward, kind of were part of the training exercise, and she was able to identify four of the five women. So the three women whose faces we can see and one of the women whose faces we can't see. And she has an open offer kind of to anyone who has any information or suspicions about who the fifth may be. But I think it's such a wonderful story, too, of her determination that we write these women back into history. Because one of the reasons I'm so grateful to my mom is that she was determined that I grow up kind of surrounded by gutsy women, both kind of in my life as a little girl in Little Rock, but also in the stories that she told me. So some of my earliest kind of memories are her talking to me about Shirley Chisholm or Barbara Jordan, or when she took me to see Geraldine Ferraro when she came to campaign in Little Rock in 1984. And so I just did grow up with gutsy women, and yet we realize that so many little girls and also little boys may not. And we hope that these stories kind of help kids and young people kind of grow up with a fuller recognition of the people who've helped move our country and our world forward.
You know, Susan, it was such a fascinating generational difference when Chelsea and I began working on this book, because when I was a little girl in post-World War II America and was born in Chicago, then moved to a suburb, I didn't know any women who worked outside the home except for my teachers and our public librarians. And by the time Chelsea was born in 1980, she had a very different experience.
When my teachers were predominantly women, but so too were my principals. My pediatrician was a woman. She then later went on to be the head of the Children's Hospital in Arkansas. And so it was just such a different world that I grew up in, and I don't think I'd understood what an impact that had on me in helping make visible kind of what should be possible until we really started working on this book together, because my mom had to really go looking and her mother had to go looking for role models in a way that I didn't, and just how much had shifted, but also then aware of how much more still needs to shift.
Now, one of the things I love about this book is your description, Secretary Clinton, of spending Friday nights with Life magazine and discovering heroines in those pages, that was something you look forward to. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, this is another generational difference. So when I would come home from school on Friday, Life magazine would be in our mailbox. And I don't know how many people remember those days or even remember magazines, but... You know, for me, it was one of the biggest awakenings. I mean, I would plop on the floor in our living room and, you know, the magazine was big and I would be turning the pages. And that's where I discovered women that we write about, like Amelia Earhart, like Margaret Chase Smith, the Republican woman senator from Maine, who was the first Republican to stand up against Joe McCarthy and his, you know, terrible tactics of ruining lives and creating all sorts of fear. It's where I met for the first time Maria Tallchief, the fabulous American ballerina, the Native American, who I got to see in person. It was the first ever performance, professional performance that I ever went to. And so the combination of Life magazine, of my mother taking me to the library, and the librarians there recommending books, that's where I learned about Anne Frank. A librarian said to me when I was about 12, I think that you're old enough to read this book. I didn't know anything other than World War II had happened and my dad had been in the Navy. That was it. And then I read Anne Frank's diary. Occasionally on television, back in the day when we had three networks, so what you watched was what everybody watched, and you actually could have conversations about it, how unique. And there was something called Playhouse 90, which did dramas, and they dramatized Helen Keller's life, so that's how I learned about Helen Keller. I learned about the first woman war correspondent who followed American troops, who had a big impact on me, and I introduced her to my daughter.
Margaret Bourke White, I guess that was my segue. You know, I do think though, Susan, one of the other differences we really recognized when we were working on this book together was by the time I was in school, you know, my teachers were also trying to purposefully kind of write back kind of into history and social studies women. Mm-hmm. And so while I kind of was learning about some really gutsy women at home and I was seeing some really gutsy women in my kind of daily life as a little girl in Arkansas, I also was learning about them in school. Some, admittedly, initially kind of fictional. Like I write about how profound it was to learn about Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz in first grade. Like, thank you, Mrs. Mitchell. I'm still in touch with my first grade teacher. She's now Dr. Mitchell. But also, particularly when I got to high school, I had a teacher who I talk about throughout the book because he really believed that for too long, kind of American history, he was my 11th grade American history teacher, kind of was just the province of old white men. And he introduced us to someone who I think we all should learn about in school, Elizabeth Perotrovich, who was a Native Alaskan activist, and she became an activist when she and her family moved to Juneau, and she walked down the street to enroll her three kids in the local public school. And the principal said, it's whites only, I'm so sorry, you have to go across town. And she said, no, I don't actually. And she forced the school to accept her children. And she thought, like, it shouldn't be this hard. And it shouldn't be a burden on every individual parent. And she worked for years and finally successfully led the fight so that in 1945, more than 20 years before the Civil Rights Act, Alaska became the first state, even before it was a state, to have meaningful non-discrimination legislation passed and made it illegal to discriminate on public transportation, illegal to discriminate in public spaces, illegal to discriminate in public schools. And like, why don't we learn about Elizabeth Perotrovich? And thankfully, next year, she will be featured on the $1 coin. So she is finally starting to get recognition, and I hope that she will be written into more history books because we should know her story. And so I just realized too, even generationally, Susan, my mom thankfully had Life Magazine and her mother. I thankfully had kind of everything my mother had learned from Life Magazine and my grandmother. But I also was really lucky to have teachers who knew how important it was for girls and boys to be learning about gutsy women in our school curriculum.
And just Susan, I just want to add, you know, sometimes people say it's an either or. Like, you know, if you learn about gutsy women, then therefore you have to quit learning about, you know, our founders or, you know, our previous heroes. No. I mean, part of the challenge we face today is to demonstrate and prove we are stronger because of our diversity. Being a diverse community, a diverse country, actually has been one of the hallmarks of the uniqueness of America. And so I don't want to say, okay, here are gutsy women, forget about gutsy men. I want to say, you know what, we're smart enough to be able to both recognize gutsy women and gutsy men and to pay homage to them. But it's really difficult if you don't ever learn about any of those women in school and if you're not otherwise introduced to them. We really hope this starts a conversation in homes and schools and everywhere else.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton about the book of Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience. I want to talk a little bit about the qualities you write about gutsiness. And I think of a very gutsy woman right here in New Orleans named Ann Levy, who was a Holocaust survivor who stood up to David Duke in the state capitol and asked him how could he say this had never happened. And when Larry Powell, this wonderful historian here, was writing about her in his book, he wrote, "First you find anger, and then you find courage." So talk a little bit about the role of anger as a motivating force for women, particularly women.
Okay. You know, I think what's important here is that the anger that you're talking about is anger at injustice. It's anger at inequality. It's anger at the doing wrong that we see around us. And if it's that kind of anger, then it's about somebody else as well as yourself. It's about somebody else being denied their full rights. And it's that kind of anger that then can motivate the movement into courage and taking action on behalf of whatever the cause might be. And we'll put her down if we ever do a sequel. We'll include her because a lot of the women in this book didn't set out to be gutsy in the way we describe them, but something happened to them. Dr. Hawa Abdi, you know, all of a sudden 90,000 people you're sheltering and Al-Shabaab shows up and demands you leave them to their mercies, and then you have to take a stand. Others went through a kind of metamorphosis, and their anger channeled them into the action they took. So two of the women that we write about are two women who were elected the first women presidents of their respective countries, one in Chile, one in Liberia. And both of those women paid big prices for speaking out for their political views. So in the case of Chile, a woman named Michelle Bachelet, who was a medical student when Pinochet, the dictator, came to power in Chile, and her father, who was an Air Force officer, was arrested, thrown in jail, where he later died. But she and her mother were also arrested and thrown in jail, where they were tortured and eventually exiled. I mean, her goal in life was to be a medical doctor, a pediatrician. She's exiled. She finishes her medical studies abroad. Eventually, she gets to come back to Chile, where she opens up a medical practice. But as she takes care of her patients, she sees all the inequities and all the lack of services for people of lesser means who are often at the bottom of the social pile. And so she begins a career in government, and eventually it leads to her being elected president. Now, when she was elected president, she really tried to use that office to offer more services for education and health care. But she also demanded that her country come to grips with having been governed by a dictator. She didn't just ignore it. She wanted people to have to understand that it had been a trauma for the nation, and they had to understand that in order to go forward. The same in Liberia, where Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was also arrested, beaten, thrown in jail, then exiled. She came back. She eventually won the Nobel Prize with another activist who we also profile, Lame Gobawi, and another activist from Yemen, who were leading women's movements against civil war, against conflict, against oppression. And if you haven't seen it, there's an incredible documentary about how women are primarily responsible for ending the civil war in Liberia. It's called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And how these women, Christian and Muslim alike, came together to demand that these warlords stop the horrific violence that killed and maimed so many people. So Ellen decided to run for office. She, you know, lost the first time. Then she was elected the first woman to govern over an African country. And it was really tough. And one of the things that she did was to say she was going to try to provide more security for girls and women. So she hired more women to be police officers. She asked the UN to send trained women military officers to help keep the peace as she was trying to help the country recover from this vicious civil war. So these are people who oftentimes knew what they were doing, or on the other hand, lived their lives until something intervened in them, and then they had to reach deep inside to see how they were going to respond. And obviously, Chelsea and I both value the characteristic of persistence, because so many of these women, athletes, artists, and others, did not meet with early success, but they felt motivated to pursue their own purpose and mission.
And we write about two groups of women that I find particularly inspiring, who are on the front lines of trying to help pass meaningful gun violence prevention legislation and sensible gun reform in our country. Women who've been engaged in this fight for a long time, often because of personal tragedy and effect. So of Sarah Brady, who became a kind of gun reform activist after her husband was shot in the attempted assassination of President Reagan in the early 1980s. Gabby Giffords, who herself was shot in the head while she was conducting an outside kind of meet and greet with her constituents, and a number of her staff and people who were there were murdered that day. And she and her husband, Mark Kelly, have just been kind of on the front lines of pushing for both real, meaningful gun violence prevention legislation, but also real data on gun violence. Because as many of you may know, like, the federal government doesn't actually collect data on gun violence. And the Centers for Disease Control is prohibited from conducting research on gun violence, shamefully. As an aside, spent some of the book talking about kind of our great admiration for everyone who's fighting for science and data. And fighting to make policy decisions based on science and data. Gabby Giffords is kind of very much doing that, and we write about someone who I, you know, just admire so deeply, Lucy McBath, whose son Jordan Davis was murdered, and she now is in Congress, and she kind of led the fight for the first meaningful passage of robust gun violence prevention legislation earlier this year in the House. It is one of hundreds of pieces of legislation that the Senate has failed to take up. But really, you know, just, you know, thinking about anger, and any of these women could have been so overwhelmed by kind of the loss of a son,
you know, ultimately the loss of a husband, kind of what happened to Gabby Giffords and how hard it is for her every day to get up and kind of move in the world, and yet they just have refused to be confined by their tragedies. And, you know, I just find that so humbling, but also a real responsibility in that. Like, if these women get up every day and are fighting to ensure that no other parent loses a child, you know, that no one else ever loses a spouse, that no one else ever has to work so hard just to lead her life every day, like, how could the rest of us not do everything we can every day?
Thank you so much for coming to New Orleans and spending time with us on this special day. What's on tap in the literary life this week? Here in New Orleans, contributor Shannon Sim signs Best American Travel Writing 2019, Sunday, December 1st at 3 at Octavia Books. Richard Campanella presents his 2019 Autumn Public Lecture, Coastal New Orleans, Lost Communities of the Urban Delta, 1820s to 1920s. That's Monday, December 2nd at 7 in the Freeman Auditorium at the Woldenberg Arts Center at Tulane University. Danielle Del Sol, Susan Langenhennig, John Pope, and Chris Granger sign Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Mary Lee Eaves discusses and signs her book, Singing Out Loud, a memoir of an ex-Mardi Gras queen, Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poppy Tooker signs Drag Queen Brunch, Wednesday, December 4th at 5 at Hazelnut, 5525 Magazine Street. Margaret Wilson Reckling signs Woody Creek, Views from a Homestead, Thursday, December 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans holds its annual read-aloud of A Christmas Carol, Saturday, December 7th at 2 p.m. at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. ¶¶